From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, we hear from our correspondent now in quake-damaged Kathmandu.
Nepal is by no means out of the woods of this disaster by a long stretch.
The Nepal quake is reverberating with Sherpas in New York City. Reaction to Iran nuclear diplomacy. And child migrants cross the Mediterranean alone to face an unknown future. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Many people in quake-hit Nepal spent another night sleeping outside or in tents, with magnitude 4 and 5 aftershocks still shaking the region following Saturday's 7.8 magnitude quake. Officials said today the death toll had climbed to more than 4,300, with about 8,000 others injured, but those figures are expected to rise. Correspondent Steve Herman is in Kathmandu.
It is a scene of chaos and devastation, obviously, but also a sign of hope. We have been greeted by people with smiles and felicitated and offered food and drink, which is, a bit unusual considering so many people are suffering here, and we know that tens of thousands are going hungry and are homeless. You get a sense right when you land at Tribhuvan Airport, which is Nepal's only international airport, just how overwhelming this disaster has been, and also that it's brought a lot of the world together. Right when we were getting off our plane, right next to us was a huge Chinese military aircraft. A squad of Pakistani soldiers were visible, and they walked right past an Israeli military team, not something you see every day. And they were in spitting distance of a U.S. Air Force C-17 Globemaster that had just landed on a long flight from Dover Air Force Base in Delaware. And U.S. Ambassador Peter Boddy was there to greet a USAID Disaster Assistance Response Team, which is bringing with it an initial contribution of $10 million in aid for battling the aftermath of this country's worst earthquake since 1934. The ambassador told me that he had met earlier in the day with the Nepali Prime Minister and pledged that the United States would do whatever is needed to help this landlocked Himalayan nation, which is one of Asia's poorest, to recover from this disaster. Then it began to rain quite heavily for a period of time, and there are just thousands of colorful tents, large and small, all over the city where survivors have taken refuge in. But we saw a policeman standing in the middle of a circle calmly directing traffic, a bit of a sign of some normalcy amid the chaos. It's still a really tenuous situation. We were driving down the street, and an ambulance rolled up to a house. Our driver said he had passed this house earlier in the day, and it had been fine, and it was beginning to collapse, and apparently that there were some people trapped inside. So while rescue teams are still trying to get to people who were trapped in the initial large tremor on Saturday, magnitude 7.8, these aftershocks and the rain are further loosening things up, and Nepal is by no means out of the woods of this disaster by a long stretch.
How about getting the aid to the people? Are the roads open enough for them to distribute the aid they brought?
In Kathmandu, the city, the capital of Nepal, you can get around. That is not a problem, although there are obviously cracks in the road, but a lot of the rubble that was in the streets has been cleaned up. The big concern are for villages closer to the epicenter, and there's no way to get to these places by road. The only way to get there is by helicopter, and we're getting reports of villages that, this village had 500 people, another village had 1,000 people, and just numerous villages like that that have been flattened, that there's no evidence that a single building is left standing. And when you add all this up, it's definitely going to amplify the official death toll, which right now is just over 4,000. But the Prime Minister of Nepal said today that he expects that the death toll will probably go to 10,000.
Yesterday on our programs, we were talking about your difficulty in getting into Kathmandu. Is that problem resolved? Is the aid able to get in now?
There have been planes landing. All the planes that want to descend on Nepal's only international airport in the Kathmandu and the Kathmandu Valley have not been able to land. You know, this is a tough airport to come into at 1,300 meters altitude, even in the best of times. It's a hazardous approach. There's no instrumentation landing system. Serious accidents are not uncommon. And, you know, what happened with us and about, as far as we know, seven or eight other flights on Monday was that they were turned away. And we were traveling with the 70-person Japan Disaster Response Squad, which was critically needed on the ground here, obviously. And we tried to fly nonstop from Bangkok to Kathmandu and were detoured twice back to Calcutta. And then finally, the captain decided to go for overnight back to our original takeoff point in Bangkok. So, you know, that flight got in more than or about 24 hours after it had originally intended to be on the ground. It appears that things are maybe going a little bit smoother today, and the Indian Air Force has decided that it's going to try to bring in some of its cargo flights on hours when there's not a jam with these other commercial flights. But yeah, it's definitely a very difficult situation getting everything needed. And we've also been told that all of the land routes into Nepal from India have been cut off at some point by avalanches, landslides from Saturday's quake.
Correspondent Steve Herman in Kathmandu. Seismologists at the U.S. Geological Survey say data obtained from sound waves, which travel through the Earth after Nepal's deadly 7.8 magnitude earthquake Saturday, may have resulted in a shift of the ground north of Kathmandu by about 3 to 4 meters to the south. Geophysicist Sanday Stacey spoke with VOA's Victor Beattie from her office at the University of Adelaide in Australia.
They've mapped the fault plane that slipped during the earthquake, and that fault plane, or the bit that actually slipped during the earthquake, extends to the southeast about 100 kilometers from the epicenter. And so there was a large amount of slip just to the north of Kathmandu, which was one of the reasons that Kathmandu suffered so much damage. And that slip was sort of in a southwest-northeast direction. So it was up to about 3 or 4 meters of slip. Everest is further west than that. And so Everest wasn't above the part of the fault that slipped, and therefore the height of it's unlikely to have changed. And if it's changed, it's been by very little.
Is it typical that earthquakes of this magnitude result in such major shifts?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, the 2004 Sumatran earthquake, which was a magnitude 9.3, had slips of about 20 meters in places.
Is it because the epicenter was so close to the surface?
No, nothing to do with that. It's a major fault, and this is a big earthquake. I mean, this was almost a magnitude 8, and so slips of several meters would be expected in this size of an earthquake.
Is this area prone to such earthquakes?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the whole reason the Himalayas exist is because you have a series of repeated earthquakes along faults there that are driving up the mountains.
Is it unusual that such a major earthquake had not recurred since the 1930s?
It's slightly unusual. I mean, the plate tectonic convergence rate, so the two plates are slamming together at a pretty fast velocity, about 5 centimeters a year. And so recurrence time might be on the order of 75 years, but those numbers are very, very weak. So sometimes you'll get earthquakes that cluster and happen very close together in time, and then you get long gaps, and then they cluster again in time, and you get long gaps.
Again, we're
so
talking... Yeah,
they're not regular.
We're talking about what's called the Himalayan or Himalayan thrust fault?
Yes.
And this joins the Eurasia to the Indian subcontinent?
That's right, yes. I mean, this is a very, very major structure. It's a plate boundary, exactly as you said, separating out the Indian subcontinent from Eurasia. It is the major feature on which the Himalayas are going up. And so the Himalayas are rising over time over a series of repeated large earthquakes. this earthquake was not a surprise.
More measurements will be taken in coming days. Do you expect any surprises?
Not really, no. I mean, there will continue to be aftershocks, magnitude 5, probably a couple of 6s over the next month or two.
Everest, of course, stands at some 8,848 meters or so above the Earth's surface. Would any change happen to these major mountain regions at all?
Anything would be insignificant. I mean, if you got an earthquake that displaced Everest slightly, then you might get a change of maybe a few millimeters or a few centimeters to its height. The Himalaya thrust is very, very shallowly dipping, and therefore 3 meters, that 3 meters of slip was primarily horizontal. So it's not going to make much of a vertical difference.
The U.S. Geological Survey says it expects occasional aftershocks of 5.0 or greater magnitude over the next year. The powerful earthquake that struck Nepal Saturday continues to reverberate within New York's Sherpa community. Most of New York's 5,000 or so Sherpas hail originally from Kathmandu, Nepal's capital, and from rural areas hard hit by the quake. VOA's Adam Phillips reports on their concern for loved ones.
The ornate, multicolored Buddhist temple in Jackson Heights, Queens, which serves as headquarters for the United Sherpa Association and as spiritual center for this community, resounded with bells and chants on Sunday as the community came to grips with the devastating news from the homeland in a candlelight puja ceremony. Community member Ong Nyangwang Sherpa, a taxi driver, said he was comforted by the ritual. But until earlier this morning, he was unable to reach his loved ones in the capital by phone or email.
But just now, we heard that T-Mobile is providing a free phone call service. So people are trying to call their families. Just before, I was talking with my family in Kathmandu, and even now, they're experiencing earthquake. 5 minutes ago, there was another earthquake.
Ong Nyangwang Sherpa feels helpless 12,000 kilometers away.
It's so difficult. We're like, can't sleep and we can't concentrate in our job. We're really in a shock and we can't, you know, really do much other than prayer, and any kind of help is greatly appreciated.
The United States, several European nations, and neighboring India have been attempting to fly in humanitarian aid and supplies, a process made difficult due to chaos at the airport and other challenges. Temple photographer Ankami Sherpa says the United Sherpa Association has raised nearly $17,000 in cash so far, but that getting that relief money to the people who need it poses its own challenges.
We are trying to fundraise some money that we just try to send there to Nepal. But, you know, in our country, governments are not so good. We don't trust government people. Sometimes they're not honest.
Ankami Sherpa notes that most of the media attention and humanitarian aid have focused on Kathmandu, but that the areas between Kathmandu and Pokhara, Nepal's second largest city, were also hit hard by Saturday's quake. On Sunday, he learned that one United Sherpa Association member was informed that her two American children, a brother and an uncle, were all killed when the rural home they were visiting collapsed, burying them. Meanwhile, the Sherpas of New York and the rest of the world continue to watch and wait for further news out of Nepal. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry told a U.N. nuclear nonproliferation conference in New York Monday that a final agreement being negotiated with Iran over its nuclear program will make the world safer. Undersecretary of State and lead U.S. nuclear negotiator Wendy Sherman told the group, Religious Action Center for Reform Judaism in Washington, that a final agreement would involve unprecedented U.S. monitoring of Iran's nuclear infrastructure and provide adequate advance warning if Iran decides to develop a nuclear weapon.
We believe that the parameters announced 2 weeks ago in Lausanne offer the best chance at preventing Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon, and just as importantly, that the alternatives fall far short of what we'll have if we're able to turn the political framework into a comprehensive agreement. Without such an agreement, Iran's breakout time to get enough nuclear material for a weapon is 2 or 3 months, what it is right now. With this agreement, it will be 1 year, up to 6 times as long as it is now, for at least 10 years. Without this agreement, Iran would expand its enrichment program to 100,000 centrifuges in the next few years. With this agreement, we will have limited Iran to operating about 5,000 centrifuges for at least the next decade. Without this agreement, Iran could produce 2 weapons worth of weapons-grade plutonium every single year. With this agreement, Iran is going to have 0 weapons-grade plutonium, and not just for 10 years, but for the lifetime of the reactor. Without this agreement, Iran would be able to expand its stockpile of currently 10 tons of enriched uranium. With this agreement, that stockpile will be reduced by 98% to only 3 kilograms of a working stockpile.
Sherman warns if Iran tries to break its commitments or violates the agreement, all options remain on the table to respond. RAND Corporation Iran analyst Dalia Dasakeh says her remarks are aimed at easing the concerns of the influential U.S. Jewish community.
There's no question that American Jews are concerned about Israel and Israel's security in the wake of a possible deal. And one of the biggest concerns the Israelis have expressed is whether this deal can be enforced and verified. And so I think that the focus on verification is not terribly surprising given Israeli concerns.
We asked if there is any doubt that Iran's intent is to eventually develop nuclear weapons.
Well, I think that the agreement is working on the premise that it is a question mark. Right now, the program is a civilian program. It would take Iran, even today, a considerable amount of time to actually enrich enough uranium to get to the point of being able to weaponize its program. So the whole point of this framework agreement and ultimately a final agreement would be to ensure that Iran's program stays as a civilian nuclear program and that they are not able to weaponize their program. And I think that is very much what the deal would be about. That's what verification would be about, to make sure Iran would not be able to cheat and move toward a weaponized capability with nobody knowing about it. So I think we are definitely far from the point of Iran becoming a nuclear weapon state, and hopefully a final nuclear agreement can ensure that that will remain the case.
Kay says the remarks are unlikely to change the official Israeli government's deep misgivings about the negotiations, given Iran's other actions in supporting militant groups like Hezbollah. However, she says if the verification measures are stringent enough, they may become welcomed by elements of the Israeli security elite. In her remarks Monday, Undersecretary Sherman also said the Obama administration will watch closely if the new Israeli government emerging from last month's election holds firm to a two-state solution with the Palestinians.
If the new Israeli government is seen as stepping back from its commitment to a two-state solution, something that all of you and a vast majority of American Jews supports, that makes our job in the international arena a lot tougher. Because our ability to push back on efforts to internationalize efforts to address Israeli-Palestinian issues has depended on our insistence that the best course in achieving a two-state solution is through direct negotiation between the parties.
Mideast analyst Michael Fishback of Randolph-Macon College in Virginia says this is all about domestic U.S. policies.
Israelis of all political stripes have been fearful that one of the concrete results of the bad blood between Netanyahu and Obama might be that the United States does not exercise veto power the next time some kind of resolution comes before the United Nations Security Council. And it was that language that she was referring to, and not so obliquely, that the next time there's something regarding the International Criminal Court or seating the delegation of Palestine at another UN body, that the U.S. might not veto. It would most likely abstain and not vote yes. So I think that was the oblique reference there, that if the kind of rhetoric, the open support for Republican candidates continues, that the Obama administration might wield that veto. And I think she made that veiled threat fairly clear.
Doesn't the undersecretary have to tread carefully concerning American Jewish opinion?
Yes, but again, I think what's going on here is a lot of strategic positioning in advance of the next presidential elections. The recent brouhaha about the Republican invitation to Netanyahu to address Congress really has caused some tremors within the Democratic Party and Jewish voters. Groups such as J Street have benefited quite handsomely from the increasing hand-wringing within Democratic circles, because it has been a party that was traditionally supportive of Israel long before the Republican Party, and yet there's been a great deal of anguish among Democratic Jewish voters and centrist Jewish voters who aren't necessarily committed over the what they feel is really rank disrespect of the president coming both from the Israeli government and its supporters. And so this is causing a tremendous degree, as I said, of soul searching. And I think these kind of comments from the Obama administration are trying to pull those people more securely into the president's camp.
Meanwhile, Israel began soliciting bids to construct 77 new homes in two settlements on occupied land in East Jerusalem. The Palestinian Authority condemned the move as a violation of international law and proved Israel was not interested in peace. Prime Minister Netanyahu has pledged to pursue settlement in East Jerusalem and other occupied areas, which Israel says it intends to keep in any future peace deal with the Palestinians. Among the thousands of migrants making the deadly journey by boat to Europe, there are unaccompanied girls and boys. Some have been sent by relatives to earn money. Others are orphaned or fleeing war. Henry Ridgewell is following the migrant trail through Europe and reports from a shelter in the Sicilian town of Caltagirone.
Like many teenage boys, they dream of playing football for perhaps Barcelona or Chelsea on the grounds of their temporary new home, a large old farmhouse in the mountains of Sicily. They practice for hours every day. Officially, they're called unaccompanied minors. All the boys living here made the deadly journey across the Mediterranean alone, with no parents or relatives. Alassane from Ivory Coast made his voyage in the depths of winter. He says 15 people died on the boat. I saw my best friend die in my arms, he says, because it was so cold, so freezing. He hadn't eaten anything. We were lost at sea. 17-year-old Ivorian Wata Ali was orphaned as a boy. He and his older brother moved around looking for work, first to Burkina Faso, then to Libya, where they got caught up in the civil war. He says his brother went out to work every day. He would come home now and then to eat and then go back to work. Then one day he didn't come back. Ali says he and a friend decided to go to Italy. They saved their money and got on the boat. Daniel Cotugno runs the refugee centre in the hilltop town of Caltagirone. He says when the boys arrive, their state of mind is terrible because they are traumatized. They have passed through Libya, where they have experienced extreme violence. When they face certain death in Libya, they prefer to choose the risk of the sea journey, where there is a possibility of surviving. To many of the boys, Cotugno serves as a father figure.
Mi rendo conto che sono pochi quelli che hanno veramente già in mente.
He says very few of them have a clear idea about their next steps. And with time, talking to them, their needs start to become clear as teenagers, just like Italian teenagers, to become football players, to study, to work, so they can help their parents in their country. But a lot of their parents or brothers were killed. The boys are free to come and go, leave the shelter if they wish to, but many choose to stay and find out if they'll be resettled by the Italian government so they can start rebuilding their lives. Shaidu from Gambia says he's very grateful for the help but is keen to move on.
I'm in this camp about 4 months now, but thank God. But I would like to move in this camp. To go to the community so that I can know how I will build my future tomorrow.
The boys' status as unaccompanied minors gives them a better chance of being allowed to stay in Europe. Until that decision is made, this hilltop home offers safety and an opportunity to stop a while on their journey to find a better life. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, Caltagirone, Italy.
Thank you for joining us for International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.